Grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft at the controls. Well, I'm sorry we won't be able to do in this hour the program we had scheduled, our conversation with dog behavior expert Stanley Coren. He's feeling a little under the weather, and so we will reschedule that show for another day. Instead, we've reaching into the Focus archives for a program that we first aired the 1st of September of last year. Actually makes an interesting companion to the first hour conversation. This is a show talking with Todd Tucker about his book Notre Dame versus the Klan, which looks at a little-known chapter in both American and Catholic history. So do keep in mind as you listen to this hour of the show that we will not take your calls. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about a chapter in American history that I'm sure few people are familiar with. And we'll be going back to the early 1920s and some events that took place in May of that year, where in the streets of South Bend, Indiana, there was a violent conflict involving students from Notre Dame and members of the Indiana Ku Klux Klan. This is discussed in a recently published book, which is titled Notre Dame versus the Klan. The subtitle is How the Fighting Irish Defeated the Ku Klux Klan. The Loyola Press is the publisher. And it tells a story that the author of the book says really has something to say about the experiences of Roman Catholics in the United States, and also about the history of the Klan. His name is Todd Tucker. He has a bachelor's degree in history from the University of Notre Dame. He also served in the military as an officer with the U.S. Navy's nuclear submarine force. He is the author of the book Notre Dame Game Day and has written for several national magazines, including TWA Ambassador, The Rotarian, and Inside Sports. He makes his home in Valparaiso in Indiana. He's talking with us this morning from Chicago. And with that, we'll say hello. Todd Tucker, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Hello, Dave. Thanks. Thanks a lot for having me.
We appreciate it. I think it's an interesting story. And as I said, and as you say, here is again one of those little known, really fascinating, little kind of out of the way stories that I'm sure that probably the people who are listening this morning will not have heard of. You know, maybe if you lived in South Bend and if you'd lived there long enough, you would have, or you have some association with Notre Dame.
Well,
I expect that most people, you know, they'd say, what? The Klan and Notre Dame students rioting in the 20s? I never heard of this.
I think even people living there, I mean, I went to Notre Dame for 4 years and never heard anything about it. And I think that even people, you know, really close geographically to the story don't know anything about it. There's a lot of people, you know, historically aware people that are kind of vaguely aware that the Klan kind of took over the government of Indiana for a few years. But really, the riot is very little talked about.
Yeah. Maybe we could talk a little bit about Notre Dame, because part of the book is a kind of a thumbnail sketch of the history of the university.
Right.
And how is it that it ended up in South Bend?
Well, that's a good question. What happened was it was for a school that's kind of famously identified with the Irish now. It was a school that was founded by the French and by a French priest named Father Edward Sorin. He came to America as a missionary when Indiana was very much on the frontier, and he went to Vincennes, Indiana, which was the head of the archdiocese and the place to be. And he immediately, being a very kind of strong-willed and independent person, Father Sorin, he was very young, he was in his 20s, he started to clash with the bishop there, a guy named De Hellandier, and they butted heads for a few years, and Sorin, part of his vision for his work in the New World was to start a college. And the bishop was already trying to make a go of one in Vincennes, so he had some land that was even more remote than Vincennes in the northern part of the state. The land had actually been given to the archdiocese by Father Badden, who was the first priest ordained in the United States. And the Bishop told Soren that, you know, if you want to start a college, I've got some land for you, and gave it to him, and I'm sure fully expected him to fail and return adequately humbled to Vincennes.
Mm-hmm. So you obviously, over the years, they had the college, the university had a number of very important and strong leaders, but fair to say, I'm sure it were not for the fact that Father Soren was a strong individual and determined for it to succeed, there today probably there would be no Notre Dame.
I think that's a fair statement. I think if you look at the challenges the school faced, it took a unique person to pull it off, and it took somebody supremely confident in their abilities and in their mission, and Soren was really, Father Soren was really the guy.
And given you mentioned the fact that he was French, he was born in France.
Yeah.
Given the fact that he was French,
the bishop was French too.
And the bishop was, where did the Irish association with Notre Dame come from?
That really mirrors the journey of the Catholic Church in the country, because the French and the German Catholics were the first ones here. By hundreds of years, and that, you know, if you look at the oldest cities in Indiana and the oldest parishes, they're all, you know, like Vincennes, they all have French names, and so they were here first, and then but the Irish, when they started coming during the famine years, they soon kind of by sheer numbers and by their great kind of native organizational talents and zeal kind of took over the leadership of the church, and what happened in Notre Dame very much mirrored that. You know, soon after Soren, there was a string of where virtually every president of Notre Dame was either born in Ireland or his parents were born in Ireland, and that's those same kind of statistics can be dug up about American bishops in general.
Mm. That's I guess again to for people to understand. The sort of to set up the nature of the conflict that here we're talking about, and you really have to understand what the experiences had been for Catholics at that time in the United States.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan and Notre Dame were two institutions at the turn of the century through the 20s that were both growing rapidly, and both they were growing rapidly for a lot of the same demographic reasons. It was because of this incredible influx of immigrants, most of whom happened to be Catholic. And, Notre Dame was kind of the bright side of that, as these Catholics tried to, strove to reach the middle class and an education. And the Klan was kind of the dark side of that, Protestant America's reaction and fear and anxiety about this, the way America was changing before their eyes.
Mm-hmm. The story here is very much driven by a few individuals, including the man who was the head of the Indiana Klan at the time, and also the man, Father Walsh, who was in leadership there at Notre Dame. Maybe we could talk a little bit about this man who was became the leader of the Indiana Ku Klux Klan.
Well, both guys, you identified kind of the protagonist and the antagonist. Both guys are really could be out of, central casting in a movie as a good guy and a bad guy. Father Matthew Walsh was from Chicago. His father was born in Ireland, Mitchelstown, County Cork, and came over here, during that huge Irish wave of immigration. Ended up in Chicago. Matthew Walsh was part of a huge Irish Catholic family in Chicago, of which there were legions. And he joined the seminary at the age of 15 at Notre Dame and never really left. And he worked his way up through the ranks, got a PhD, and kind of established himself as Notre Dame's wunderkind, and became vice president in his 20s and ended up becoming the longest-serving vice president in the university's history. And during his tenure as vice president, he also did a tour of duty in World War I, where he was distinguished in battle during the Second Battle of the Marne in France. He won the Distinguished Service Cross in France and came back and resumed his vice presidency. I'm sure when he did, he assumed that the fighting in his life was behind him.
Yeah, little did he know what was ahead. The man who was the leader of the Indiana Klan at the time was a man named D.C. Stevenson,
right,
who was not a native Hoosier. He'd been born in Texas.
That's correct, David Curtis Stevenson.
And made his living as a salesman, and apparently was quite a good one. What's interesting to me is that in terms of his politics, that he started out as a socialist.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, you know, D.C. Stevenson was first and always a salesman, and he was born in Texas, and his first job in politics was he worked for the socialist candidate for governor of Oklahoma, and he kind of learned what the campaign trail was all about and how to have an all-day rally and how to recruit people to a cause there. But even when he was he also signed up for World War One, and even the Army kind of recognized that the guy was a natural salesman, and they made him a recruiter rather than sending him overseas. And in the post-war years, he really started to kind of make a name for himself in sales. He sold typesetting equipment to newspapers and stock in a coal company and memberships in a veterans group, and was really kind of a prodigy. He became very rich as a salesman, you know, years before he'd ever heard of the Klan.
Yeah, and that's how it is. He, in fact, got involved with the Klan because he had this reputation as a skilled salesman. And
that's
somebody
right.
in the Klan who was interested in enlarging its membership, at least there in the state of Indiana, came to him and said, how would you like to have a job selling the Klan?
Right.
And initially he told the guy to take a hike until the guy said that, well, you know, there would be something in you for this because there's a membership fee that gets parceled out in various ways. But for every person you recruit into the Klan, you would get, I think it was $4.
Right.
Was it? So, and then he thought, well, you know, that's not so bad at $4 a head. And he apparently said, yeah. And it doesn't sound like he was particularly interested or moved so much as by the politics of the Klan or by their ideological views as the opportunity to make a buck.
But he did, I think Stevenson, being, you know, a shrewd salesman, he recognized that the creed of the Klan, at least the patriotic half of the Klan's creed, where they talked about 100% pure Americanism and standing up for Protestant values, Stevenson recognized that that would be a very marketable pitch to his, you know, fellow Hoosiers, which he'd only been a Hoosier for about a year at the time. But
yeah. Our guest, maybe I should introduce again for anybody who might have just tuned in. Our guest is Todd Tucker, and he's the author of the book that explores this clash that took place in Indiana in the 20s between the Indiana Ku Klux Klan and Notre Dame University. And very specifically, there were a couple of days of street rioting involving students and Klan members. His book is titled Notre Dame versus the Klan. It's published by Loyola Press. He does, by the way, have a website if you're interested in finding out more about him or about the book, which is toddtuckerbooks.com, and that's Todd with two D's. First time I put that in there, I only had one, and it told me it couldn't find the website, and then I went back and realized, it's T-O-D-D,
that's
Todd
right.
Tucker Books. So, and, of course, the book is out and available in the bookstores if you want to take a look at it. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about, around this period, also the history of the Klan, because it was an older organization. It was indeed organized during Reconstruction, but then it sort of went into decline, and then there was this resurgence that right around this time.
Right.
And some people might know, others not, that in fact the Indiana Klan was one of the largest any place in the United States.
It was the largest. I mean, the Klan in any historical era reached its absolute pinnacle of power and numbers in Indiana in the 20s, but, you know, by a far measure.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk a little bit about this up and down, and particularly, was there some reason why there was this real big resurgence in Klan activity and membership around this time that we're talking about?
Well, the Klan, when you look at the Klan historically, it really has kind of three incarnations. And the first one, like you said, was immediately after the Civil War. The Klan was founded by a group of Confederate veterans in Pulaski, Tennessee. And the purpose of the group was to kind of maintain social order in the face of radical Reconstruction. And the group grew rapidly. they managed to get Nathan Bedford Forrest, the Confederate hero general, to be their leader. And but within a few years, the Klan was it really kind of evolved into a terrorist organization, a vigilante organization, too violent even for a guy that had been in almost continuous combat for the entire Civil War, Bedford Forrest, and he ordered the Klan disbanded within just a few years of its founding. And so then the Klan was dormant for decades. And then what really caused the second incarnation of the Klan, the one we're talking about in the 20s, was the D.W. Griffith's masterpiece motion picture, The Birth of a Nation, which heroically depicted the Klan of Reconstruction and inspired a guy named Colonel Simmons in Atlanta to refound the Klan, so to speak, along the lines of kind of a fraternal membership organization.
Hmm. I don't know if anybody knows precisely the numbers, but at this time, again in the 20s, literally hundreds of thousands had hundreds of thousands of members in the state of just in the state of Indiana.
Yeah, well, the membership rolls were secret, and that was a big part of the Klan's appeal. They called themselves the Invisible Empire, but most research seems to indicate that it was somewhere on the order of 300,000 members in Indiana at its peak, which would be about one out of three white men, and those members included the governor of Indiana, the entire Indianapolis City Council. The sheriff of Indianapolis of Marion County, and was just the Klan had permeated every level of civic life in Indiana.
We talked a little bit earlier about this man, D.C. Stevenson, who became the head of the Klan in Indiana, who initially was brought in simply just to recruit, bring in new members. How is it that he went from that role to actually running the organization?
Well, I think it's it's like a lot of businesses where the the most successful salesman ends up working his way to the highest levels of management. Stevenson had the credibility; he was selling memberships like no one ever had, and was making himself and everyone above him in the Klan very, very rich by selling these memberships. So when he wanted to do something or make a decision with the Klan, people had to listen. He was also accumulating political power along the way, making friends and donating money and kind of consolidating his power politically in the state.
So we sort of touched on this earlier, but how dedicated do you think he was to the ideological agenda of the Klan?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's easy to say, looking at him, that he didn't care at all. But I think the important thing to realize is that the kind of racist, nativistic, intolerance of the Klan was very much in the mainstream. I mean, I think the Klan didn't make anti-Catholicism mainstream. The Klan became mainstream because it was anti-Catholic. Mm-hmm. So I think Stevenson was probably no more intolerant than average, but that's not to say that he wasn't. I think Stevenson's first priority was always to grow, his bank balance and his power in the state, and he used the Klan's, philosophy to make that happen.
Yeah. The Klan, their sort of official ideology rested on their own identities as Protestant, white Protestant Christians.
Right.
So
pure Americans.
Yes.
I mean, that's the way they would have put it.
And that they looked at, they essentially at this time looked at Catholics as being aliens.
Right.
And had this thing about the fact that somehow they were beholden to the Vatican, and so that not only they were aliens, but they were in a sense agents of or supporters of a foreign power.
Right.
That was the way that they looked.
That was kind of the consolidation of the Klan's philosophy, was that they can't. How can you be? And this has been central to anti-Catholic thought throughout the ages. It was, how can you be 100% patriotic when you have this loyalty to a foreign ruler, i.e. the Pope? But I think it's important to realize that that they thought that Catholics were aliens. Well, as a matter of fact, a lot of those Catholics in the 20s were aliens. They were from other countries, and many of them didn't speak English, and they were, going to their own schools and their own churches, and it was not it wasn't inaccurate for the Klan to point out to people that, they were different and they were changing the face of America. That was all true. I mean, I think that it was inevitable that the scale of immigration at that time was so huge that it was inevitable that there would be some kind of reaction, and it just the Klan happened to kind of be there to capitalize on that, on those feelings.
Well, specifically, what led the Indiana Klan to decide to target Notre Dame?
Well, Stevenson's main recruiting tool all along, and his most successful recruiting tool, had been these giant all-day rallies. He'd had one in Kokomo the year before on July 4th, where he was actually coronated Grand Dragon, and that had been, you know, the biggest rally, biggest Klan rally in history anywhere. About 200,000 people attended, and it, you know, really went down in kind of Indiana legend. So these rallies were a big technique for Stevenson. He had one in Kokomo. He had one in Valparaiso. And at the time, South Bend was the second largest city in Indiana. So it was just kind of natural from a, you know, a marketing slash recruiting point of view to schedule one in South Bend. At the time, the timing was such that the Klan's power was really starting to peak. That the rally was scheduled for May. Was scheduled for May 17th, and earlier that month, Stevenson's man, Ed Jackson, a Klansman, had won the Republican nomination for governor. So the things were, the Klan was really on the upswing when the rally was scheduled.
Well, what did the Klan think that they were going to do? And did they actually think that they were going to close down Notre Dame, or was simply the agenda was to try to get attention for their agenda?
I think, you know, that Stevenson, well, you know, in most of Indiana, this wave of immigration that I keep talking about, Indiana was largely untouched by that. Indiana's population of non-native-born citizens was always lower, way lower than average, always way lower than Illinois or Ohio or any state around it. But South Bend and St. Joseph County, those areas of Indiana were the exception. They did have large immigrant, large Catholic populations, mostly because of the steel mills and the heavy industry that was up there. So I think Stevenson recognized that there might be some, you know, that might be some good recruiting ground up there where people actually, you know, knew Catholics and had Catholic churches in their backyards.
And
I think Stevenson's intention was definitely not to to march on Notre Dame and shut it down, but it made for a convenient, you know, backdrop for his rally.
Yeah. I want you to talk a little bit about the students and their reaction to all of this. And interestingly enough, as you point out in the book, Notre Dame has never required students to be Catholic.
Never.
And at the time, maybe something like a quarter of the students at Notre Dame were not Catholic.
Right.
So you could expect that there, you know, if they had some feeling of loyalty and allegiance, it was to the institution, to their
right.
University.
Well, it was, yeah, Notre Dame in its early history would have been unthinkable for them to allow only Catholics because there weren't any Catholics up there. The school would have shut down within weeks. I mean, there were, you know, Soren always had to accommodate the Protestant population and always has. And his early advertisements, he always said that they would make no attempt to change anybody's religious creed and stuff like that. In fact, it was one of the real interesting statistics I found is that I think Notre Dame is a higher percentage Catholic now than it was, you know, 100 years ago. It's about 90% Catholic today.
Well, how did we get to this point, this sort of boil over point that ended up with these riots that I mentioned a couple of times that took place in May of 24?
Well, right? it's like a lot of kind of historical moments. There were a lot of factors that added up into a riot. I think the administration had advocated all along just ignoring the Klan, and that had always been their philosophy towards kind of anti-Catholic nonsense, was just ignore it and eventually it'll go away. And it always had. But keep in mind, like I said, in May of 1924, the Klan was one step away from putting an avowed Klansman in the governor's office. And it was getting harder and harder for not just the students in Notre Dame, but for a lot of Catholics to believe that, you know, the Klan was just going to go away on its own. Add to that Notre Dame had grown so rapidly because of, like I said, all those demographic forces at work that they couldn't keep up housing all these students on campus, and a great number of them lived in town. So they were out, you know, looking out their boarding house windows when the Klansmen started to file into Notre Dame. So, you know, and I think that the Catholic consciousness was at that point where it was. It's interesting when I first found this out, I had the reaction like you did. I was like, how is this possible that the Klan took over a state and they were riding the streets with Notre Dame? But as I researched the book, I decided that really, you know, the story I wanted to tell was not how it was possible, but how it was really inevitable. That these two institutions were on a collision course for years, and some kind of collision was going to take place, and it happened in May of 1924 in the streets of South Bend.
Yeah. Well, I guess the precipitating event initially was there was going to be a Klan rally,
right?
And why? I guess again, it comes back to the question of why is it that the students just couldn't have left this alone.
Well, the administration certainly wanted them to. Father Walsh had posted a bulletin, you know, kind of commanding all the students to stay away and remain on campus. But there was no precipitating incident. There was no cross burned on campus or anything. I think it was just the students kind of general awareness that, you know, they had robed Klansmen were directing traffic in city streets, and there was a Klansman was getting ready to become governor, and these were men who, you know, had taken a vow to fight Catholics, and that what everyone anticipated would be the flashpoint for real violence would be a parade. And there had been precedents for that the Klan parades in Pennsylvania had led to shootings, and so that was kind of the thing that everybody was worried about. And a lot of the Notre Dame students went into town to quote-unquote stop a parade if there was one.
Mm-hmm. And what did they do?
Well, that the Klansmen who were coming in down were not expecting resistance. I mean, when they went to these rallies like in Kokomo and Valparaiso, they were welcomed with open arms. It was an event that to them was about as threatening as a 4th of July picnic. So as they were getting off the train platforms and were getting hassled and roughed up by these Notre Dame students, most of them were just completely shocked more than anything. They were not prepared for that kind of reaction. Like I said, the Klan was the most popular membership organization in Indiana. They weren't used to people, you know, being against them. So the Notre Dame students started hassling them and roughing them up, and it kind of quickly became that a set of Klan robes kind of became the prize trophy of the day if you were a Notre Dame student. So they started running these guys down and taking their robes, and the Klansmen were just in total disarray, and they ended up gathering at the Klan headquarters building in South Bend at the corner of Michigan and Wayne Street. And the Notre Dame students followed them there, and a crowd gathered, and they had a fiery cross in the window, which was actually made out of light bulbs, not of flames. And the students decided that would become their target, and they started hurling potatoes at it to extinguish the cross. So if you were a Notre Dame priest and you were worried about the image of Irish Americans, that was about the worst possible image you could have, was potato throwing Irish mobs. But that's what happened.
Yeah. Well, how did the leadership of the school respond to that?
Well, in a couple of different ways. They were furious that the students had disobeyed them on such a grand scale. But they also held the city accountable. They thought the city had really been unprepared, and they had tried to warn the city that, you know, something like this was a possibility, and it just seemed like the police had just thrown up their hands and let the whole thing happen. So the administration was upset, and they were worried. There was the potential for real violence and real bloodshed. It had happened before, so there were a lot of worries.
Well, and then following that, there was another kind of event where there was apparently the Klan and the supporters of the Klan decided that in as much as initially the students, their attitude was, well, we're going to teach these guys a lesson. We're going to show them that we don't believe in what they stand for. We're not going to let them have their
exactly.
parade, whatever. And then after that, the Klan and its supporters essentially said the same thing. Well, we're going to show these kids a lesson, and it happened. And there was much more in that second sort of event. There was a lot more physical violence.
Yes, that's
than
true.
There was in the first.
That first day that I just talked about was May 17th, which was a Saturday. Sunday, there was pretty much no violence. The students remained on campus, and the Klan kept to themselves. On Monday, the Klan was, really stinging from what had happened. And the sheriff's department, which was largely controlled by the Klan, they deputized about 25 Klansmen as sheriff's deputies, and then they kind of set a trap for the Notre Dame students during the Klan's regular Monday night meeting the South Bend Klan's regular Monday night meeting, they called on campus and said that, you know, a Notre Dame student had been attacked in town. And the students, having had such a great time on Saturday hassling the Klansmen, they all gathered up and rushed into town ready to kind of continue the fun. But when they got there, the Klansmen with billy clubs and the sheriff's department was ready for them, and the students really took a huge beating. Mm. And that was where the chief of police, Lawrence Lane, who was actually a Notre Dame alum, he called Father Walsh and said, "You've got to get down here. Something bad's going to happen." And so Walsh drove down to the courthouse lawn where the Notre Dame students had kind of temporarily retreated, and he climbed atop a cannon of a Civil War monument and made a very kind of dramatic, spontaneous speech to bring the students back to campus. And they listened to him, and that was the end of the riot.
Yeah. Was this something that got national media attention at the time?
It did, and like I said, a lot of that was just this image of a potato-throwing Catholic mob was just kind of irresistible for a lot of the national press. So, but a lot of the publicizing was done by D.C. Stevenson. He quickly published an account of the whole thing in book form and sold it all over the country because he wanted to show that, you know, the Klan had been attacked by this intolerant Catholic mob. And so his account kind of held sway there early on.
Hmm.
The Klan and Stevenson definitely won the early public relations war in that.
Hmm. Let me again introduce our guest, Todd Tucker. He's writer. He's also an alum of Notre Dame. He went to school there, studied history, and is the author of a book that gives these events in much more detail here than we can do in our conversation, obviously. The book is titled Notre Dame Versus the Klan. And it's published by Loyola Press. Here is a caller on our toll-free line in Chicago. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
Morning.
I find this very interesting. I was a little late to the show, so I apologize if I ask a question. But during this problem, didn't Nuke Rodney also go down there and try and get these fellows to come back to the campus?
That's a great question. It was one of the real kind of most kind of made-for-Hollywood moments of this whole thing. Nuke Rodney. He didn't go downtown, but what happened was after the Monday riot, Walsh realized that something had to be done. And while Walsh definitely had his problems with his famous prima donna coach, the highest paid member of the faculty there, he knew that Rockne had a demonstrated ability for kind of motivating young men. So Walsh called a meeting at Washington Hall of all the students, and he had Rockne speak to them, where Rockne gave kind of a halftime pep talk, telling them that they were all members of the Notre Dame team, and Father Walsh was their quarterback, and they had to listen to his signals. So, yeah, Rockne had his part to play in this. And I think significantly, too, you know, like I said, in May of 1924, the Klan was kind of at its peak. Their man was elected governor the following November. But within a year of that, D.C. Stevenson had been convicted of murder and imprisoned. And that following football season, Newt Rockne and the Four Horsemen won the first Notre Dame's first national championship.
Well, I believe J.P. Stevenson was convicted because he ravished a woman.
He kidnapped, raped, and brutalized a woman where he basically...
Madge Oberhauser, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. And he basically chewed her to death. And that the reports of that brutality were just so horrifying to the average Hoosier that was really the one event that led to the almost instant downfall of the Klan in Indiana.
You know, that's interesting because the Klan has always claimed they protected white womanhood from the ravages of the mongrel hordes and this kind of thing, and yet here you have this incident.
Well, and that's a really good point. I mean, I think that's, you know, that was why it led to the downfall of the Klan so fast. The Klan had promoted itself as this defender of Christian virtue, and also, you know, a big part of their platform was a defense of prohibition. And during Stevenson's trial, it came out that, you know, in addition to being a monster to this woman, he was drunk more or less continuously on illegal alcohol. So a lot of the kind of dark underbelly of the Klan was made visible to Indiana.
Yeah, you know, it's surprising how much of this stuff didn't go out. Here in Illinois, there was a big shootout with the Klan, and bunch of them were killed, along with some sheriff's deputies and a sheriff.
Hmm. I don't know.
So it's surprising how much of this stuff is sculled away in history, I guess.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. One of the things that I think is interesting in your interest in this event and these series of events and the conflict between the Indiana Klan and Notre Dame is that it does mark a kind of a turning point for both the university and for the Klan, because after that we do see the decline in the Klan, and as you've explained, it partly has to do with the personal decline of D.C. Stevenson, who had been the Klan leader, and also the beginnings of real national respect for the university, both as an institution of higher learning and also as because of the success of football team.
Notre Dame was on its way to football fame before this. George Gipp had been Notre Dame's first All-American in 1920, but that first national championship where Notre Dame won the Rose Bowl and the Four Horsemen photograph and Grantland Rice's famous piece of sports writing, that really... it really cemented Notre Dame's fame, and it was very interesting to me as a historian that, you know, after the most anti-Catholic year in American history, that Notre Dame would win its first national championship and become kind of a beloved institution.
Yeah, I asked the question about did the riot involving the Klan and the students get national attention, and you said yes, and unfortunately it was, at least from the perspective of the university, pretty negative.
It was the
potato throwing Irish mob. But did in the long run, was there something about these events and this particular conflict that worked in the university's favor?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, part of the reason that Notre Dame took the worst of it in the publicity was that Walsh refused to kind of acknowledge that anything had happened and refused to talk about it, whereas D.C. Stevenson, a very, very accomplished manipulator of the press, took over. So, you know, his account kind of became the account of record, whereas Walsh kind of maintained his silence. But, you know, it's interesting that, you know, Walsh's philosophy had been that, you know, if we ignore these yahoos, eventually they'll kind of collapse under the weight of their own ignorance, and that's really, you know, exactly what happened. So Notre Dame certainly never made a point of bragging about, you know, the worst episode of City of South Bend relations in the university's history. It was something they preferred to keep quiet, and I think just the memory of this kind of wide-scale anti-Catholicism was a painful memory and not something they really wanted to relive.
Mm. We have a couple of other callers. They are both in Champaign. Line one first. Hello.
Yes. I was wanting to there's a book, Bloody Williamson, and it's about Williamson County, and there's a lot of things about it, but there's quite a bit about the Klan.
Hmm.
They're real big in Williamson County, Illinois. And I think that's the name of the book. I'm in the car right now. The other thing too was that there was in Rantoul, Illinois, the Klan marched on by the Catholic Church, and in Penfield, I understand they I heard stories from one of the kids about that they crosses were burned in front of the church. And there's one gentleman that just walked out while the Klan was there and knocked the crosses down, and nothing was done.
Hmm. So. Well, the Klan, you know, while it peaked in Indiana, it was definitely. It was definitely big across the United States, and particularly in the Midwest. So,
yeah,
Illinois and Ohio had their, and Minnesota and Wisconsin, they all had their Klan chapters.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right. Well, let's go to line number two. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested in the rise of the Klan at that time. How much did it have to do with hard times in rural America? Of course, this was before the Depression, but the Depression started in rural America before it did elsewhere.
Well, that's a really good question, and I think that's the kind of the big historical question that people need to answer, and there's been a lot of scholarship about it, is what was really driving, you know, this Klan growth. And there's a lot of theories. You know, one of them is definitely that, you know, there was had to be a reaction to the magnitude of immigration, but a lot of it is what you said, this rural reaction, not just to poverty and hard times, but to everything that was going on at that time in America. I mean, that was when you had, you know, Prohibition was in effect. Sacco and Vanzetti were executed. The Scopes trial, I think, was in 1925. So if you were, you know, a farmer in rural Illinois in 1924, you had a lot of reasons to think that America was changing, and not necessarily for the better, you know. And if the Klan promised to kind of address that, you can see why that would be an attractive sales pitch.
The other point was the first Klan. It's claimed to be protecting the South against radical elements who happened to be black. These radical elements were not really very radical. They were simply educated black men, some of whom had come back, some of whom had been in the South,
right,
who had come to power through fair votes.
Well, I think, you know, radical Reconstruction is a historical term. It's not a not a moral judgment.
I realize that, but particularly after the movie Birth of a Nation,
right?
I think people tend to take it literally. I think called themselves liberal Republicans in those days rather than radicals.
Well, I think if you would ask, you know, your average Southerner, and, you know, my book is mostly about the 1920s and not about Reconstruction, but I think that they viewed the oppressors of radical Reconstruction not as freed blacks, but as a vengeful Northern government, a vengeful Northern federal government. I mean, I think those were the villains to the South in Reconstruction. They viewed the freed slaves more as kind of pawns of the vengeful North, and as they tried to extract the revenge from the South,
which historically probably is not an accurate interpretation. But then the Southerners wrote history in the 1890s to the 1920s very largely.
Mm-hmm. They were right in thinking that the North was trying to change their way of life. I mean, that's what the Civil War was about. So, you know, they were right.
You're absolutely correct.
They were correct. They weren't, you know, right in the moral sense. But
well, thank you. This is an interesting chapter in history that I wasn't that familiar with. You realize we had a really bad riot in Springfield in, I think it was 1908, but this was against blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. On to another caller here, someone in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I have a number of things I want to mention. That with regard to the KKK, just in recent years, it's been spreading to areas of the country where you wouldn't think they would be located. I speak specifically an area that I know of in north central Pennsylvania. Around Williamsport, Pennsylvania, there's a large population of them there, according to relatives that I have.
Hmm.
And also, there's a bunch of right-wing militants who have moved out of Idaho to an area around a small town in Pennsylvania along U.S. 6, northwest of Williamsport. And these are essentially the same kind of nuts who inhabit Idaho, where all the rest of this has been centered. Now, with regard to the local situation, the American Legion was centered around Indianapolis. That's where its original headquarters were, and
right.
Where
I believe it's still the headquarters of the American
Legion. It still is, and the money that went to organizing the Legion was right-wing money from right-wingers, and the top of the Legion essentially has been essentially reflecting right-wing politics. Mm-hmm. And it's not so surprising that their politics in many ways parallel those of the KKK, not necessarily the murderous part of it, but all the rest of it.
Well, I don't know anything about the American Legion. I didn't.
Well, I'm telling you, this is a case. It's from my reading of history, and a while back.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you wanted to mention?
Not that I can think of at this point.
Okay. Very good. I appreciate the comments. I don't know any other comment, Todd, you'd want to make on
that? I think, you know, there is one point I'd like to make, and I think it's, you know, why is this so little known? I think one thing that's really interesting about the Klan movement in the 20s in Indiana is how quickly the thing rose and fell. I mean, when you talk about D.C. Stevenson coming to Indiana and becoming the Klan's recruiter, that happened in 1920 in Evansville. And then the big rally in Kokomo, you know, was in 1923, and then the Klansman governor was elected in 1924, the same year of the riots. And then Stevenson's murder conviction was in 1925, and the Klan collapsed. So the whole thing rose and fell inside of about 5 years. And so the whole thing was really quick in historical terms. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that makes it interesting and one of the things that makes it, you know, not that well known.
Hmm. We have a caller here in Terre Haute, line number one. Hello. The caller there, line one in Terre Haute.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. The Klan has had their annual national rallies up here in Park County. They did anyway 10 years ago or so. I just wondered if they are still doing that in Towns Mansfield in the middle of the covered bridge country.
Hmm.
Are you familiar with that at all?
Well, you know, I talk a little bit in the book about the Klan today, and I mean, really, the main point I want to make is that whatever... The Klan today is really the third incarnation of the Klan. The Klan of the 1920s in the North collapsed with Stevenson's murder conviction, and then it totally died with the start of World War II, because the Klan had kind of allied itself with the Nazis, and when World War II started, the Klan found itself on the wrong end of a congressional investigation. And the head of the Klan at that time, who was from Terre Haute, by the way, his name was James Colescott, he disbanded the Klan for the second time in its history. So the Klan was dormant again. The Klan that's alive today is the third incarnation of the Klan, which really came out as a response to the civil rights movement in the 60s. So, you know, there is a Klan today, but I think it's historically distinct from the Klan of the 20s, and there's no way you can compare it to the political influence and the mainstream status that the Klan had in the 20s.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And I think, again, we'll go to a caller on, I think we have new caller on, do we have new caller on line number four? Okay, let's go there. Line four, hello. We have a caller on line four? I guess not. Well, we're coming down to the point here where, in any case, we're got maybe a minute or two left. You know, one thing I'm just, this is maybe just the tiniest bit off the subject. I think a lot of university sports teams have followings among people who never went to that school.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that any has as great as Notre Dame for people who follow that team, particularly the football team, who are not graduates of the university.
Right.
Maybe it's people who have Irish heritage, and maybe that's the thing that attracts them to the team, the nickname and the symbol. But I guess you can't really quite underestimate the importance of the success of the team in terms of helping to establish an identity for the university, and a very powerful, a positive identity for the university, too.
Well, they've got a name for those guys. They call them the Subway Alumni at Notre Dame, I think that definitely, you know, the fact that Notre Dame kind of became the official team of American Catholics early on and was, you know, very successful throughout the 20s and 30s and 40s has a lot to do with that. I think that, you know, now it's just been ingrained in people, but I definitely think the identification with Catholics and with the Irish in particular definitely has a lot to do with that.
Well, we will have to stop there. If you'd like to read more about the story, look for the book that we mentioned titled Notre Dame versus the Klan. It's published by Loyola Press by our guest, Todd Tucker. Also, he has a website that has a little bit more information on him and on some of his work, which is toddtuckerbooks.com, and that's two Ds in Todd. And thanks very much for talking with
us. Thank you for having me. It's been great.
You've been listening to a Focus 580 program that we first presented on the 1st of September. And again, the guest is Todd Tucker, talking about his book, Notre Dame versus the Klan. We're sorry that we were not able to bring you the program that we had scheduled, the one that we were talking about, conversation with Stanley Coren. He's a psychologist at the University of British Columbia and is well known as an authority on dog behavior. We were going to be talking with him about his book, How Dogs Think, Understanding the Canine Mind. And unfortunately, he was not feeling well, and we said, well, rest. We'll get you scheduled on another day, and we'll be very happy to do that show. In the meantime, of course, we did this archive, and if you're interested in catching up on past programs that you might have missed, interviews from Focus 580 from the Afternoon Magazine. All of our local production is available on our website. That is WILL.UIUC.EDU, and you are welcome to go there and listen anytime you like. Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast is also made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium at 203 North Vine Street in Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information is available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Tomorrow morning on our program in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest will be Brian Deal. He is Assistant Research Professor in Architecture and Urban and Regional Planning at the U of I. And we'll be talking about a model that has been developed here at the university to make decisions, or at least to help planners make better decisions about land use and about what those things will mean a little bit further down the line. So we'll talk about that in hour number one. And in hour number two, our guest will be Sister Helen Prejean. She is a Roman Catholic nun who is probably best known for a book that she authored entitled Dead Man Walking, which is about her experiences dealing with men on death row. She has a new book out, which is titled The Death of Innocence, an Eyewitness Account of Wrongful Executions, in which she argues that, in fact, there have been men executed, sentenced to death, put on death row, and executed who were not guilty of that crime. So she'll be talking with us tomorrow morning in the second part of the show. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Hope that you will stay with us here. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we'll have the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn. Coming up on 1 minute before noon, time to turn things over to Celeste Quinn for the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at cell phones, plans, and service with one of the editors of Consumer Reports magazine. Our guest will be David Heim. We'll talk with him about some strategies for saving money when it comes to paying the phone bill or bills. The magazine reports in its current issue, the February issue, that households with landlines and wireless service spend an average of $1,400 a year for their phones and service. David Heim of Consumer Reports magazine, our guest.